Douglas, seeing that one doesn't have a head here presents a different, if I could say, model of relationship from the one that we're used to, which is a face-to-face model. That's the way we've been brought up to see ourselves in relationship with other people. What difference do you think it makes to see that you don't have a head here where you are in terms of personal relationships?
Well, I think it makes total difference, don't you? In fact, it calls in question the very word relationship. If I see, and I do see, that here am I gone, so to speak, that Douglas no longer exists in this place, what relationship can this non-existent have with that existent out there? I mean, can nothing, no thing, rather, not nothing exactly, no thing aware of itself as no thing, how can it be related to things? It seems to me for there to be a relationship, it has to be between things of the same order. Put in very, very simple terms, it seems to me like this, that if I am something here, if I have a face here, if I'm a solid lump here, if here is a solid meat ball, a thing here, and I am that thing, and there, you over there, a similar thing, I'm absolutely and entirely and clearly designed to shut you out, and to serve notice on Richard, keep out Richard, I've got one. It's like a rejection of Richard, not because I could have anything against you, but I'm built for rejecting you, really. I'm built for pushing you away. I'm not open to you by nature. I'm close to you by nature. Well, that's one kind of thing, and one kind of setup, isn't it? And it's the kind of setup that I observe all over the world, symmetrical setup. I see people confronting one another.
Face to face.
Face to face. I see symmetry all over the place. And this is our paradigm pattern of personal relationships, face to face. Who ever heard of anything different? Well, here it's totally different from that. And I see that I'm built to let you in. I'm built, as it were, for loving. I say as it were because it doesn't involve necessarily a sentiment, a strong feeling of any kind. But it does, if I attend to this, I consciously let you in because I've no option. I'm open to you. And I become you in your richness. I mean, I'm now full of Richard. I'm invaded by Richard. I am so much Richard at this moment, which I guess you're not. I'm giving Richard his richness. I'm giving him his all his status, qualities, character, personality, as Richard as a human being, and that's my business to look after that manifestation here, which I call Richard. And I'm completely busted wide open for that. And in a less sure and certain manner, I would guess that you're doing the same thing for Douglas. And this is a very beautiful, very strange, very intimate business, isn't it? This trading of faces, trading of appearances.
Yes.
I am here no thing for Richard, and Richard there is no thing for Douglas. And we're doing this for each other. We're giving each other human status, really. A very, very precious and wonderful thing to do.
Yes.
It's something you can't do for yourself. I have to do it for you to give you human status in this time, and vice versa. So it's a really, really big difference. Yes, the difference is total between the setup that we can see now, first person, third person, and the one we see over there between two other people, which is third person, the total difference. And what we have done is to model our idea of what personal relationships are on looking at other people and ignoring our own situation. We've taken objects as clue to the subject. Mm-hmm. And there are no clues to the subject. The subject and object are quite different.
Whereas up till this point, being that someone else might have given one a face, now one can be with other people and let them take your face
take
off,
it off you.
It can be a great reminder of seeing who you are.
Yes, yes. And so, Richard, this makes a total difference to the way we get on with people. I know that it doesn't immediately seem to have any startling effects, but in the long, long run, I'm absolutely sure it transforms the way we do get on with people. I think not too quickly, because we have to get out of the old habits, don't we? But it really takes the fear out of the eyes over there of the other person. It takes my fear of those eyes from me. It means that I don't feel threatened by those eyes. I'm not frightened of that appearance. I don't feel under inspection here. There's nothing to be inspected here. I feel free to look into that person's eyes in a way I never was before. So I don't look at those eyes of yours as windows through which two little tiny spooks are peeping at me. I just see that as the appearance of Richard, and those little windows, so-called, are no more spooked out than your lips and all your noses. They're just as objective. Now, where do I find the subjectivity of Richard at this time? Because I don't deny him subjectivity. I don't deny him a consciousness. Where do I find it? Well, I find it this side of your face, not your side of that face, but my side here, if I find it right here. Because the consciousness I perceive here, looking back at this place I occupy, this awareness, this space, this clarity, this aware-nothingness that I am here, I perceive to be infinite in extent, crystal clear in its awareness of itself, and altogether fitted to be the consciousness of all beings in the world. Why? Because it has no Douglas label on it. It has no official labels at all. Neither Richard nor Douglas or anyone can claim this as private property. The awareness I find here is big enough, aware enough, and impersonal enough to do for Richard and me and all the world beside, and indeed, God's awareness could not be different from us. In fact, that's one way of putting it.
So there aren't many consciousnesses.
Well, I think the idea of multiple consciousnesses is nonsense. I find consciousness only here. And I take that very seriously. I mean, I travel all over the universe, peering into everything and inspecting everything. I won't get it. I won't ever discover anything which has a smell, a hint of this awareness, this sense of being oneself, the I am feeling, the I am sense of I am. I will never find it any place in the whole universe except right here. And of course, this right here, this point where I find it, when I look here at this point, which I'm pointing at now,
yes,
I find it explodes to be of infinite extent. So it's not something which is a private little possession here at all. It's something which explores to take in the whole world. It seems to be, really, in a way, to be wider than the wide world.
In fact, it's
and
not,
deeper than all else.
It's not in a particular place, because
no,
everywhere
it's all
is
over.
In
it's,
it.
It's all over the place. Yes. I mean, it, you know, the view out into my world is so puny, really, compared with the view back in this direction, which is of infinite extent, clarity, and
in every
aliveness respect, to itself.
Yeah. In every respect, looking out is different, totally opposite from looking in.
Yes, that's right. But, of course, there's another thing I must add here. We don't say, I can't find anywhere separating them. I can distinguish them totally, and I need to distinguish them totally. And when they're distinguished totally, they come together totally. If they're anything like, if the view in is anything like the view out, then they never come together. But if the contrast is total, in other words, one is the capacity for the other, the contrast is total, the unity is total. I see this to be the case. In other words, the space I have is its filling. And when I look, so when I look out at Richard, just look out, well, I'm missing half the story. When I say Richard plus Richard in the world, I'm only getting half the story because I'm leaving out this half, the half in that lies in this direction. But if I look in this direction, why, I'm getting the clarity and I'm also getting Richard filling it.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that my whole business in life is to look here. Because looking here involves there, whereas looking there doesn't necessarily involve here. So for my whole business in life is to look here. Now, if I do that, coming back to the ritual question, what does this do for personal relationships? When I look here in my so-called relationships with other people, it's not that I'm related to them at all. As I say, I have the experience of being them. And how am I them? First of all, it's a double identity. First of all, I have their appearance, which they apparently don't have themselves. They tell me they don't. My friends tell me that where they are, they ain't. Well, first of all, I have their appearance. Secondly, I am here, this awareness, which they are. So I don't relate. Ultimately, I relate to nothing whatever. I am you. There are three possibilities here, I suppose. One is that I am what I took myself to be, what I've told I was, what society brings me up to claim to be, namely a human being just like the ones I see around, kind of solid, perishable object. That's number one. Number two is just space. I mean, you know, just emptiness for other human beings, just sheer emptiness. That's all there is to it. Like a kind of vacuum filled to be filled with the set and the other. But there's a third possibility, and that is vastly different from both of them, I think. And it is that this place, it's true that about what I find here, and that no words will compass it, no words will describe it. It has no characteristics. It receives all characteristics, but none of its own. And it's free of all characteristics. And paradoxically, this gives it just incredible value. You know, there's a saying in the Upanishads, it recurs in various scriptures from different one way or another, that we get happiness and satisfaction and peace only from what is open-ended, unlimited, what cannot be comprehended. that is, it is totally beyond our framework of reference. It's something that breaks through from outside, totally mysterious. And from that we get satisfaction. We get satisfaction only from the unlimited, never from the limited, never. And so the third one I'm talking about is the no thing, which really is no thing. I mean, really is indescribable. But I am it, and therefore it's the one thing I really know without being able to describe. And it's something that just baffles me to put a word to. But it is the one thing I really do know from experience, and that is what I am. And what am I? It is no thing, aware of itself as no thing. But this being totally mysterious, self-originating, incredible, ungraspable, unknowable, thereby becomes mysteriously what I can put my money on, my infinite resource, you know, something so precious. Something I just can't find any words to talk about, to describe it. Can you help me here?
Well, I'm just wondering if one is, you know, when it comes to this place, then I know the word God doesn't even begin to fit, you know, and yet it has a certain power that gives some indication of who one is. But what do you think there is to convince one or convince others that this is really it, this is really coming to the source? It doesn't look or feel like anything, does it?
Well, I think certain things can be said about it. I think what comes and goes, what is changeable, that I cannot rest in, I cannot find my peace. But it's not my source. That which can be known this way or that way, or even known at all, is something I get my intellectual tape measure around. That's not my resource. My resource has to be, to use that old word, ineffable, ungraspable, totally convincing, totally precious, but for no reason, really. I suppose what gives me the entree, in a way, more than anything else, to this sense of my identity, this identity which is incredibly nothing and incredibly valuable, what gives me the entree to it is its self-origination. That it's the abyss from which I am proceeds. It's more fundamental, infinitely more fundamental than the sense of I am. It's like a sense I am not, first. But it's the fountain. It's the or it's not the fountain, it's where the fountain comes from. It's the source of the fountain of I am-ness. Which is myself coming into being. It's below being. It's where being comes from for no reason. It is the bafflement, really. It is the vertigo. It's the giddiness, really, of the Godhead.
Yeah.
investigating its own origins, which are unknowable. And the Godhead or God is totally bowled over by this. And this, strangely, this ignorance, this not knowing, is profoundest kind of knowledge somehow.
Clearly it's not Douglas seeing this, is it?
No, I mean, I can't find anything remaining of that guy. I mean, he was over there, and he certainly is. It's as though one has levels. The bottom level of all is the unspeakable no-thingness, the unthinkable origin of which we could call I am not, from which I am proceeds. And then from the I am, that level, you get the I am thus proceeding from there. I'm Richard, I'm this, that, I'm the universe. And these are various levels of manifestation. But I feel that my refuge, my resource, my joy, my blessing comes from what is below existence, below being, below thought, below feeling, from which it all comes. In a way, the potentiality of everything is more precious than the actuality, because it is so, I don't know, so deep, so resourceful, so much you can rest in the potentiality. The actuality is always flying off in beautiful creativity, isn't it? So the fountain is never, I mean, the point about a fountain is always in motion. But the motion, I can't rest in the motion. I have to go back to where it's all coming from.
That nothingness is so endlessly astonishing, isn't it? It can never be grasped or hallowed or understood or
there.
And yet it's the source of such awe. Really.
Yes. And the beautiful thing is, it's so mysterious, but just this act, the simple act of turning around 180 degrees puts us in immediate touch with it.
So this seeing is not a shallow thing. I mean, it's a simple, the most simple thing, but it's looking to the very depth.
Yes, it really is. Infinite depths. I mean, looking out into the world, one looks out into a cul-de-sac. One looks out into some terminal, some terminus there. You know, where there's the sky and the trees or Richard or that desk. There's an end to it there. But looking in this other way, 180 degrees, the vista goes on and on forever into depth on depth of unknowable mystery, and above all the mystery of why, how does it contrive itself? Do I contrive? It's unknowable.
Yeah.
And I'm quite sure that God's greatest joy, and I think at least one's own evidence of this, God's greatest joy is his own ineffability. A God that's got himself taped would be so, I don't know, thin, meager, shadow. And this is a most extraordinary joy, the joy of how can one express this wonder? How can one do it justice, Richard? It baffles one to describe it, doesn't it?
Totally.
But just turn around and you're in touch with it once.
What would you say about the whole idea of bliss? Do you think bliss has a place or reality?
Yes, I suppose that people mean different things by bliss. I can tell you what I think it, what meaning I would give to the word, whether others would share this same meaning, I don't know. But what I've been describing is that'll do. It seems to me that when I get onto the manifestations of various levels of this creative source of this mystery, when I get onto those particular manifestations, why they don't hold bliss, they have no bliss to offer me. The bliss is to be found in the at the point of origin, really. You know, there's an Upanishad which talks about joy. I suppose it's the same word, ananda, joy or bliss, being at the root of everything. And it's joy that creates the world and achieves being. Its very nature is joy. And other creatures, it said, others, must live on a diminution of that joy. So it's as though the world is coming out of joy, but getting less joyful as it goes on. Well, I think the thing is to be in touch with, and to be not in touch with it, but actually to be the joy from which the world comes, which, taken by itself and apart from that, is dukkha, suffering. I think the joy, mysteriously the suffering is somehow taken care of from its origin.
Is this joy something that comes and goes?
Well, I don't think it is. It's no. I think that it is timeless, really. And why should I think that? Well, because when I contacted, you can say it looks as though I'm contacting it now and not 5 minutes ago when we talk about something else. But when you contact this region, you don't have a sense of returning to it. You have a sense that there's no interval between the occasions of enjoying it, no interval whatever. And for all sorts of other reasons, which we could go into. This, which is the center of my being, is because it's changeless, just because it changes, and because it's empty, because there's no thing there. There's no possibility of changing, there's no change and no time. And this is forever my reality. Not something that comes and goes.
In being this, one is aware that everything is within one, as if one's arms are around everything, nothing is excluded.
Absolutely. And this brings one to the question we haven't discussed yet, which is, in a way, I think, the basic question of our lives, is our identity. You know, you've got this great tradition which, flying in the face apparently of common sense and modesty and certainly the popular view of things, says that I am not a man. I'm not a man. By me is God and I recognize no other, says Saint Catherine of Genoa. And you have scores of the great mystics coming from all the great religions who find their true identity is none other than the source of that world. And that one starts off with a provisional identification with this, that, the other, what one sees in the mirror, and so forth, and our undoing, our trouble is that those false identifications, and well, my own way of putting it, as you know, it's a very simple one, become the language a bit coming from my childhood. To be saved is to be him. To be saved is to be him. And that, well, from every point of view, this works out. Nothing else works out. Nothing else is true. Nothing else is true. Everything but God perishes. Well, am I perishable? Or am I made of God? As Beatrice said she was. And I think it's, in some sense, it's just a matter of looking to see.
But in another sense, is it something that grows with one? Does it mature? Does this sense of one's identity deepen?
I think the vision of it is that it does not deepen. The vision of it, the direct apprehension of it is the same throughout, because there's nothing to be grasped. How can the grasping become more, or what is grasped change? I don't see any possibility of that. And in my own experience, I think my first view of this is not different from my last view of it, nor different if there are other views of it. You know, in a certain sense, you could look upon others as viewing this too. I mean, once you introduce the possibility of levels and degrees here, I'm back in trouble again, very deep. But that's not the point. The point is that I can find nothing here to change at all. I find no difference, no development. But when it comes to the expression of this in my life and its connection with all the downstream stuff of my life, why then it's capable of ongoing change forever and ever, as far as I can make out. The experience itself is the experience of one's infinite, oneself as infinite capacity, infinitely clear, infinitely deep and aware. One's experience of that is the same all through. Timeless, changeless, bottomless, ineffable, indescribable simplicity.
Does it affect your sense of what you want, your personal will, your desires? Where does surrender come in?
Gosh, that's so important, isn't it? It's so important. And,
do you have any personal will?
Well, I find here perhaps rather surprised in a way that the Douglas's personal will, or at any rate his strong preferences, are very much around, and I'd much prefer to be healthy, or if I'm not healthy, I get better from what I'm suffering from. I much prefer even a nice day to miserable cold weather. I prefer all sorts of beautiful things to ugly things around. I prefer that my friends are happy and things are going well with them, and infinitely prefer that to the reverse. So in that sense, one has an enormous array of strong preferences, not to say one's will is, if you call it will, is quite active. That is so. And I don't find much change there. In fact, I don't find any appreciable change there. No. But at the same time, there's another side to the whole thing. And that is that constantly, when I'm seeing who I am here, which I'm doing, the seeing of who I am here is surrender, because it's not really surrendering all one's hopes and will and desires. It's surrendering the idea of someone here who is having those. I mean, it's not a case only of surrendering personal will, but surrendering the person who has the will. So it seems to me that implicitly and in principle, this in-looking, this in-seeing that we're talking about is surrender already. Already it is total surrender, because it doesn't leave a speck of anything here. It doesn't even leave a person to exercise will, let alone will here. But I would say it's as though Douglas out there is doing his willing thing. It seems that that's a part of his, condition of being Douglas. And I think to pack up all that sort of thing would be to pack up altogether. He wouldn't be around. He wouldn't be around doing his thing and being a human being, which I take him to be. And there he seems to be carrying on normally. If he didn't have a whole host of preferences, strong preferences too, that seems to me what makes him Douglas. And without to pretend that those are weakened is simply to say that you're getting tired of life. I mean, it's not being tired, it isn't being virtuous. No, I think that is, I think that to have strong preferences for this and that and the other is perfectly consistent with surrender to. And what is the surrender then? Well, it is staying here at the center, and from the center, surveying all that's going on there, including these preferences, and carrying on merrily there, seeing them from this position, surveying them, exercising them, taking responsibility for them, from this joy or this satisfaction or this strong sense of the mystery, the one's identity here, as the origin for whom nothing can go wrong, for whom all is well. See, if I am who I'm advertised to be by in the great mystics and great religions have said I am, if I am that, if I am the one and the only one, the alone, what can have gone wrong? And in what sense can my will not be carried out? If I am who I am, which is the one, the alone, and alone by inclusion, not by exclusion, by including all beings, not by excluding any, if I am that, then my will is done. I can conceive no way in which there's nobody is frustrated, no way in which it cannot be, it can be frustrated. So, in being who I am here, I am surrendered to whatever happens because it is basically my will. And that is perfectly consistent with noticing that as long as Douglas is around, he's got a whole repertoire of stuff that he would like to see happen. I put this very badly, but the living together of these two things is important.
Yeah.
And it's not saying Douglas is going to be a kind of milk and a creeping Jesus, a kind of milk and water saint that everything is acceptable to equally and got no preference. No, not at all.
We're so deeply conditioned to be somebody, aren't we, right from the beginning of our lives. How do we get off that? How do we get to deep surrender? How do we get to really deeply sensing we are who we really are?
How do we get to?
How do we fulfill our heart's desire in that sense?
I I don't think we can get to it by contrivance or by training ourselves, really. I think it's mysterious. It's, you know, I'm inclined to take refuge in a word which is really cop-out in the sense, grace. You know, it explains nothing. I'm looking back on my life, why is it that this has been my life? It has been my life, and I've been a pretty poor exemplar of the whole thing, but it has been my life. Now, why has it been my life? Why should I have elected to go for this thing rather than to become a successful architect, or I don't know, whatever else I might have tried to do? And why? How did I do that? I think it happened to me in spite of me. It happened in spite of all my resistances to it. And I don't know. It's one of those questions I cannot answer. I think that I tried very hard to avoid this, and I got pushed into it. I suppose really having a very tough time when I tried anything else. I mean, I pushed into this, I suppose you could say, by the unsatisfactoriness of the alternatives.
Yeah. Do you think that seeing this and carrying on seeing this, as it were, helps you as a person? Sorts out some of your problems, hang-ups, relationship problems, whatever?
Well, absolutely no question about that. I mean, what it amounts to is saying, do I think that living from the truth is more satisfactory than living from fiction? Of course it is. And you would say, well, Douglas, I don't notice that your life is so uncomplicated and, you know, so different from other people's. You seem to have a few problems knocking around. So you could certainly say that it doesn't seem to sort out one's life entirely. No, I think the answer is to see these two things going on. There's a Douglas thing going on, and it's as it were peripheral. It's out of way out there in the mirror, and Douglas is not here. And Douglas is a creation of this, a manifestation of this, and considered on its own by itself, is about as crummy as most similar manifestations. In some ways, a little less crummy, but other ways more crummy. I think not very satisfactory. In some ways, I'd say deplorable. Well, looked at by itself, but seen from its origin, accepted from its origin, it's a totally different thing. It seems to me that when we look at things, really the only way we can see the world is from the origin of the world. That's a very, very remarkable thing. The only way really to see the world is from the place where it all begins, namely the void, the clarity here. The only way you can see the world. Now, let's do it consciously. Let's see it consciously from its origin. And then I think we shall say that it is pretty poor stuff, and Douglas is, as faulty and troublesome a character as any other. Yes, seen at its own level, but seen from its origin, somehow it's okay, and it's perfected. And you could say nothing's gone wrong somehow. Nothing's gone wrong, which is a very conceited thing to say. At its own level, everything seems to be flawed, vitiated, I mean, somehow spoiled. Seen from its origin, not so.
So this undercuts, in a sense, the view that one has to reach some kind of spiritual level before one gets enlightened?
The word enlightened is one I don't care to use very much, but for master is that word. Well, there are two views here on the one is two traditional views. One is that in order to find out who you are and become enlightened, you have to polish yourself up, reform yourself, go for discipline, one discipline or another, become qualified to make this a momentous discovery about your identity. And this is the end product of a long period of training, months, years, perhaps lifetimes of discipline. And a lot of people have believed that and tried to follow that path. But I think the consensus is that when at last they come, those people, if they ever do come to see who they are and become enlightened, that they give a great big laugh and say, what was it all about? And it was that all I was really trying to do was to polish a brick. That all along I was not a brick, I was a mirror. And this polishing is all rubbish. And that I see that all my discipline, all my achievements, all my improvements were totally irrelevant. And from the start, I was who I was and enlightened from the very beginning. And then, of course, there is the other school who recognizes that from the start, that you start with enlightenment and then you go on to deserve it later, practice it later. You start with the easy thing, which is seeing who you are. Because you see, all this spiritual discipline is damn difficult. It requires a great strength of character. I would say, in many ways, a cramping thing. It's something which you have to pay a very, very high price for. Very, very difficult. And by contrast, in total contrast, this inward look that we're on about, this turning around the air of your attention, looking within, discovering here, this central perfection, which is one's very source. This is a bit of cake. It's simple, it's easy, it's the one thing I can do. It's the easiest thing in my life, is to do that. It's easy, but it's something we, avoid doing. Incredibly simple to turn around. It's the one thing I can do really properly. I can't make a muck of it.
Why do you think we avoid it?
Well, that's a mystery. I suppose God doesn't want to... God having decided he or she was going to play hide and seek with himself or herself, having decided that he would divide himself apparently into parts in order to experience one day the joy of coming together again, doesn't want the game to be over too quickly. That's one way of putting it. Why individually we avoid this? Well, I suppose, don't you, that there's one fear we have above all else, and that's the fear of vanishing without trace, disappearing. And I think we all have a hunch that when we really look to see this thing that we built up here, we see that we just don't vanish, there's nothing left. And that reads like annihilation, which we're so very reasonably scared to.
So just going back to the discipline bit, do you think there is any place for discipline, for practice, or can we just do what we want?